And a special welcome to the half the town of Watkins, who has come today to look after some of their concerns. It's nice you can. How far is it for you to drive in? Oh, okay. Well, anyway, welcome to the committee. We don't have a quorum yet, but Representative Franzen is here, so now we can start. For those who have bills, we're hearing four bills today. For the advice of the bill authors, we're going to be taking up a topic of geographic rates first, so you have a little bit of, so you can enjoy learning about geographic rates. And if you're lucky, you'll get to be on the committee someday, Representative. you're doing a little talk today. That's good. And hopefully Representative Schumacher shows up so he can take the gavel for part of this.
Oh, that's just going to get to his head.
I think he's probably... Anyway, okay, so his constituents are here too. So we'll start off. Welcome to the committee. And then we're going to go for a half hour better, I think. Do you have quite a presentation in mind? Or?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. And Bob Held is here as well, so he will be coming. I will do a short piece on the ICFDD, and then he will talk about nursing facilities as an overview.
Okay, well, thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, my name is Alex Bartolik. I am with the Department of Human Services, and I am here to give an overview of intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities. This has been known historically as ICFMR. These are facilities that do serve people with developmental disabilities. However, the name was changed because the term mental retardation is offensive in many situations, and the legislature did change the terminology for that. Intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities provide a 24-hour plan of care and treatment and habilitation services for people who need a higher level of care. Now, not everybody with a developmental disability will qualify for ICFDD services. There is a level of need threshold that includes a need for a 24-hour plan of care, habilitation services, and this is determined by medical and psychological evaluations and an assessment that is conducted by counties. ICFDD provide the 24-hour care, active treatment, training, and supervision to people to help people acquire skills with the ultimate goal of helping people be members of their community, be able to be as inclusive and possible, and having their health maintained to the best outcomes. And over the years, these services have changed, and we now have many services that provide specialized services, including units for people who have Alzheimer's and also including hospice services. Like nursing facilities, ICFDD include all services, comprehensive range of services, and housing and food. Now, many people, particularly people of working age who live in an ICFDD, either go to school or participate in a day training and habilitation program or supported employment services to be able to also receive needed services. The ICFDD certification and financial participation by Medicaid started in 1971. Counties currently pay 5% of the rate when a facility serves seven or more people. Otherwise, it is the typical match between state and federal dollars. There's two types of licenses, a Class A and a Class B. And Class B licensed facilities typically serve people with higher medical needs, and these are individuals who wouldn't be able to take care of themselves if there was an emergency. They need someone to assist them. When Medicaid first became available in 1971, the state hospitals became certified as ICFDD, and they were also began receiving the Medicaid match, and they served thousands and thousands of people, and we're all familiar with those facilities, the regional treatment centers. They stopped, the ICFMR certification ended with ICFDD on the regional centers a decade ago. The last person moved out. So now all people are served by private vendors or state-operated providers, but in smaller community-based settings. There also was a large growth in this certification and capacity across the state by private providers. And at the peak of this, there were over 9,200 ICFDD beds across the state. And at the current time, there's 1,848 beds that are located in 59 out of the 87 counties. Now, most of this change in the ICFDD capacity occurred as a result of converting those funds to home and community-based services, particularly through the DD waiver. So it was an option, and many providers changed their business practice in order to be able to offer home and community-based services instead of the ICFDD. The backside of your first page, there's a few charts just to give you a little bit of what's happened over time. The first one shows the number of beds just in the time period from 1982 to current, where we show that the number of beds are declining. And whenever somebody leaves an ICFDD facility and that bed closes, the funds are converted to home and community-based services so people can receive appropriate services in the community. There are currently 218 ICFDD facilities. They range in size from 4 beds to 64 beds. There's 151 facilities with 6 or fewer beds, downsizing, which is reflecting the downsizing trend. But half of the beds are in the metro area. The average age of people who live in a facility is 49. And what we see across the state is that people moved in at one point, they like living there, or their families, close to families, the providers know them, and so there tends to be a long length of stay. And it is people who have had more of a historic presence in a facility. The majority of residents have lived there in the next graph, as I said, for an extended period of time. This isn't a location where people tend to come in and out. It is someplace where people, once they get settled in, live for an extended period of time. Unlike nursing home, provider rates are not based on a case mix, and there are no adjustments for geographic location. The ICFDD rate system actually initially was done through a rule process, which was a cost-based reimbursement. There was a change to a new reimbursement strategy in 2000, but since then, provider rates have only been adjusted by the cost of living, and as you know, sometimes that's gone up, but there also has been a reduction in the rates. The average monthly cost for someone to reside in a facility is $6,491. There are a couple of ways in which additional dollars can help provide services. One is called a variable rate. If a person has high medical or behavioral needs, some facilities are eligible to be able to apply for an additional increase to their rate for a period of up to 12 months. There are criteria about this, and it has to be a facility whose overall rate is below the average rate in the state. There are also variable rates. Excuse me, I'll back up. The variable rates were unallotted in July 1st of 2009, so anyone who currently had one could continue that, but no new rates were authorized. They are now allowed again. There are currently 62 people who do have a variable rate. There is another option, and if people wish to retire from a day program and a provider is responsible for 24 hours, there can be application for services during the day rate, which basically gives the residential provider 75% of the dollars that would have been spent in the day training and habilitation program to help offset some of their costs there. Now, a few years ago, there was a study to look at ICFs and what's going to be the plan for the future, because there's been a lot of downsizing. It created a different pressure in the system than we had had before. And after going through the study, there were a number of recommendations that were made on things that could be done to look at managing the system differently. It is a system that is slowly, through attrition, downsizing or closing. Many people do prefer home and community-based services as a more flexible way. Some of the providers are finding that that's also a more flexible way. But again, as we just talked about some of the demographics, we know that some of these facilities are serving people who are older. They have been their home for many, many years, and this is something that the facilities would like to continue providing services. The last sheet includes some of the recommendations that came out of the rate, was to allow variable rate, that increase if people have high medical or behavioral needs, to all facilities, and not base it just on some of the facilities that have rates that are below the average, to allow it to pay for modifications to a building or for equipment to help offset some of the cost of designing services differently. If people do retire and don't attend a day training and habilitation program, to allow 100% of those dollars to be used to add on to the ICFDD rate, to eliminate the county share for those facilities that are larger than six beds, to create some one-time rate adjustments to pay for increased staffing, and to also allow for some payment rates for vacant beds to keep some capacity in the system. There were some recommendations from the report that have been implemented, but at the time it was also another period when hard decisions were being made, and since many of these would require some investment, in some cases modest, but would require an investment into the facilities, they were not all implemented. We are bringing together the stakeholders who participated in this study to help us bring this out, to go back through the recommendations and some other strategies to see if there's some additional steps that we can take. So this is just a short overview, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Before we go to questions, we do have a quorum now, and Representative McDonald will move the minutes.
I sure will. I'd like to move the minutes.
All right. All in favor of the February 17th minutes being approved, say aye.
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 All right. Minutes are adopted. And are there any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about the home and community-based waivers and the utilization of waivered homes for the population currently served in ICFDDs. I love when we change the acronym. It's going to take us a year. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about our experience with the care of the DD population in waivered homes, and if that is proving to save money for the state? Are they less expensive? What is the value of making that transition?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, historically, when you think of the context of all of the ICFDD facilities that have been there in the conversion, it has saved the state money. So it was both a policy decision, but it also did create savings for the state. There are certainly some facilities that may cost more, and there's some people on waivers that may cost more. We manage things on an aggregate average. These are lifelong services, and at any given point in time, depending on transitions, health needs, there may be increases in service needs and then subsequent decreases in needs. But this has been a cost-effective alternative. It is one of the directions that all states across the country have moved in order to provide flexible services that can be modified.
Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with us if there is any trend information about the care of this population in the waivered homes? If, you know, if as you make the transition, it's saving money, is that savings, is the trend line showing savings, or is the cost of the care going up in the waivered homes? Is there a trend for us to look at?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we can provide you more detailed trend information. It has been less expensive to provide services to people in home and community-based services. Mm-hmm. As you see, the majority of services being converted to home and community-based services, so we are serving all people of all needs, including very, very challenging and complex needs. Certainly the cost of home and community-based services has also at times increased, but still on the average it has been cost-effective.
And just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you help us understand why, if the population is, what is different between an ICFDD and a waivered home if the population is transitioning from one to the other? Where's the cost savings if the population is remaining the same in terms of its complexity?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the change in the funding has primarily been due to the way that services can be provided. ICFDD has a lot of regulations. There's a lot of requirements. It is a federal and state certified program. The home and community-based service options, states are allowed to define the services, define the provider standards, as long as they meet certain assurances, and there typically has been more flexibility to modify services. And we also have legislation that is requiring all of us to look at those standards and say we think we can streamline them even more in the home and community-based service side.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Bertolic. Are there any people that aren't on medical assistance in the ICF DDs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, there are a few people. We do have some ICFDD that have a specialized niche, and sometimes other states will use them, or there will be some private pay, but it's just a handful of people, and I can get you the specific number, but I am believing it is less than 10. Oh, seven. Seven people reside in an ICFDD.
I don't need any further information then.
Okay, any Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I'm looking at this cost, $6,491, and I'm wondering, does that include the day training and habilitation services, or is that a separate fee?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
for the month.
That is the average cost for services in the ICFDD. It does not include the day training and habilitation. It does include housing and food.
Okay. So could you give us an idea what the day training costs are? That's something that they do during the day, correct?
Yep. I can get back to you with some more information that shows the complete set of costs.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Are there any further questions? All right, Mr. Held.
Afternoon.
You also, by the way, you have 23 minutes for your presentation. Thank you.
Okay. I was asked to talk about rate disparities in nursing homes, and based on the chair's permission, I believe you've been given a copy of a report that the department produced. It's dated on the second page, March 2010.
Yep.
This is what it looks like. And I'll be using this as kind of the framework for my remarks. We start out in the report talking about what do we mean by rate disparity? And in discussions with our stakeholders, we identified 14 forms of rate disparities, or disparities in general. And we decided that there were really three of them that were the most pertinent to the interests of legislators and facilities when this issue comes up. And that would be differences in the operating payment rates to facilities within an area of the state. That would be the first. The second one would be differences between areas of the state. And the third disparity would be the difference between the rates that are paid to a facility and the cost that it takes to operate that facility. And that third one is of intense interest, but it's not what I'm going to talk about today. That is an issue that is addressed by the nursing facility rate rebasing law that was passed about 3-4 years ago, and is still in law and is scheduled to resume its phase-in in a few years. So if there are differences in rates between facilities, does it really matter? Why does it matter? And what we and the stakeholders believe is that the disparities will result in a number of differences in the operation of the facility. It will result in wages that are different. A facility that has disparately low rates will not be able to pay competitive wages with one that has disparately high rates. The benefits will be different, staffing levels will be different, and really resources for any other uses that the facility may have, from improvements to even the quality of food could be different. The report goes on to pose the question, and you'll see this on page 4, is there an association between the rates and the quality delivered by the facility? And on the bottom of page 4, what you see is a chart. It's called a scatter diagram. And it shows each facility is a circle on that chart. And they're located based on, from right to left, what is their per diem, and from bottom to top, what is their quality score. And when you look at that, it looks pretty random. There appears to be, and in fact, statistically, there is no correlation between those. I had commented a year or two ago in committee on that and was challenged by the question, yeah, well, that's all facilities together, but how about if you did it geographically? So what you see on the next page are three scatter diagrams showing the relationship for each geographic group, the deep rural and metro. And again, you can see that it's still random. And in fact, the association here is like less than 10% out of 100. So our conclusion is that the disparity in rates is not associated with disparities in quality, that there's other things that are at play there.
We have a question from Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, on those three charts, is it the top chart, is that deep rural, then rural, then metro? Is that how I read it?
Mr. Held?
That question, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, was going through my mind as I was describing those, and given that they all look about the same, I wasn't too sure. Do you know which is metro? Oh, I see. Okay, and that's Rule 50 geographic group. So the top one is metro, and the bottom one is what we call deep rural. And interestingly, deep rural has, on average, the lowest rates, and here you can see that they're all above the diagonal line in regard to quality. Almost all are. And it is actually rather suggestive that maybe low rates are associated with higher quality, but we needn't go there. But if it were that simple, I'd have a great proposal for you.
I got a solution to the budget.
In addition, there is a. I'm gonna come to that in a moment. Okay, so. Because this has been of so much interest, there have been a number of actions taken in legislation over the last decade or so to try to reduce rate disparities. In the year 2000, rate adjustments were given to facilities, regular COLAs were provided. But in addition to those, there was a rate adjustment intended to reduce rate disparities. Every facility got an amount between $1 and $4.13. And it had some effect. The following year, the legislature enacted a two-year program to call for staged reductions in rate disparities. And in addition to what at that time was each year a 3% across the board rate increase, facilities were provided with up to a 7% increase for each of the 2 years. And that was an amount that was determined to bring them up toward or to a specified rate floor for either rural or urban facilities. And if the 7% didn't bring them quite to the floor, then they would get the full 7. And if it didn't require 7% to get them to the floor, then they only got to go up to the floor. In 2006, there was a provision enacted in which all the facilities in three specific counties were given rate increases to bring them up to the metro median. That particular facility was in our provision addressed facilities in the St. Cloud area and allowed 13 facilities to get increases that ranged up to 21% of their operating payment rates. So they were quite substantial. Well, because that was done in a limited part of the state, it provided us an opportunity for a natural experiment to occur. And we evaluated what happened with those homes. We were curious especially, well, did wages go up? Did they add staffing? And did the quality improve? And what we found was that their net bottom line improved. In fact, it went up eightfold. There were some increases in wages. There was no discernible increase in staffing and no discernible change in quality score. So, moving on, why are there rate disparities? How did this come about? And it's a little bit awkward, but it forces me to describe about 25 years of nursing home reimbursement history, one of the most fascinating topics, I'm sure, to most of us. In 1985, the state implemented what was called Rule 50. It was a cost-based method with limits based on geographic groups and categories of expense as to how high expenses could be that would be allowed to be translated into the operating payment rate. That was a successor system to Rule 49, which operated in, you know, a lot very much the same way. One of the things that changed was that Rule 49 allowed for inclusion in the rate of known cost increases, and Rule 50 did not. It required that the facility spend the money, get it into their cost basis, and then have it translated into the rate. So essentially, starting in 85 and even before that, the rates were cost-based. And when I say cost-based, what I mean is that you take the total cost spent in a category of expense, say nursing cost, you divide it by resident days, and you get an amount, and that's the amount that goes in the rate. That's the amount that can be subject to a limit. And that, by the way, since I used in my example nursing staff, would also be the amount that would be case mix adjusted. In the mid-90s, the state was having a budget problem and implemented a couple changes to nursing home reimbursement, setting additional limits on spend up and limits on facilities that had the highest rates. The legislature chose at that time, in addition to those limits, to offer facilities an option to get out of the cost-based system and move into a rate-on-rate system. A rate-on-rate system means we're going to look at your rate on the last day of a rate year, and we're going to adjust it by CPI. Just inflate that amount. That'll be your rate beginning and for the next year. The legislature always has the option of saying, well, we're going to do something different. And that's happened for most of the years since. Well, that was called the Alternative Payment System, APS. It's a rate-on-rate system. And initially it was considered a voluntary competitive system. The legislature set limits as to how many facilities could sign on to APS, and it was very competitive for the first year or two. By 1999, all facilities were reimbursed with their operating payment rates under that methodology, and a few years later actually were strongly encouraged to sign the APS contracts as well. So during those few years, the industry was gradually shifting from being cost-based to rate-on-rate-based. And whenever they became rate-on-rate-based, their rate was essentially frozen other than natural inflation. So during the period that was used to set that rate that became converted to the rate-on-rate, the facility's costs reflected a variety of business decisions, issues having to do with the competitive environment for labor or care or other spending. All of those things became frozen into the rate-on-rate model. Now, why would the state want to go to something like that? Well, and why would facilities? Well, the idea was, would the state please stop micromanaging nursing facilities and instead, and not require them to file the cost reports, go through all this audit stuff, disallow all kinds of costs, and then have all kinds of dispute resolution activities. Instead, just give us inflation, let us manage our business the best way we can. That was the attitude that kind of led into the enactment of that law. And the intent, as I understood it at the time, was that the APS model would be in place for 2 or 3 years, maybe a little bit longer. It's been in place now for about 12 years at least for all facilities. And during those 12 years, what's happened? Well, the environment within which facilities has changed, within which they have to operate, has changed. It may have become much more competitive in some ways and not so much in others. And the nature of that change would be different in different parts of the state. So while they were under the cost-based model and the state was trying to encourage facilities to operate with the moral imperative to not spend more than they had to spend. The state can't afford to just willy-nilly spend as much as everybody might like. Some facilities took that kind of encouragement to heart. Others said, hey, we're going to go up to the limits. So whatever the situation was at that time when the facility did their last spending in a cost year that became used for a rate year, that set them in motion on the rate-on-rate system with no way to depart from that model until these rate disparity provisions that I described earlier were enacted. Okay, then in 2007, the legislature enacted what we call the rebasing law, and that first began to be phased in 2008, and as its name suggested, it's a cost-based system. It was, however, provided in various amendments that year with an 8-year phase-in period. So the first year of that phase-in was in 2008. In that year, the legislation called for the department to set rates based on combining part of their APS rate with part of their rebasing rate. And we were only using rebasing for 13% of that and then 87% from the other. We were supposed to go to 14% each of the following 2 years and then start moving up about 17% each year on the rebasing side. However, because of budget issues that were happening at that time, the phase-in was changed due to some legislation, followed by unallotments, followed by additional legislation. And the next 4 years were suspended, and only on 10/1/2013 do we move to the step of rebasing that was scheduled to happen at that time. So how do you get out of this? If you want to deal with the rate disparities problem, rebasing, frankly, is not going to get you there. What it's going to address is that one disparity, the difference between costs and rate. But it's not going to deal with the disparities within an area or between areas. And to answer that, what I'm first going to do is mention that theoretically there are three ways that you could set nursing home rates. You could use a cost-based method, you could use a pricing method, or you could use a rate-on-rate method. And I've described two of those. A pricing method would simply be a matter of saying, all right, we're going to keep case mix, we're going to do all these other things, but we're setting a price, and it's the same price, the same set of operating payment rates for all nursing homes. That would be a way to go. With any one of these three models, you could overlay it, and currently some of these features are included in the system with case mix. You may want to, and I think the state has been doing this for a long time and we want to continue, to adjust rates based on acuity. People who have greater needs should be associated with higher rates. The alternative is that you're creating a very powerful incentive to only admit the lowest need people. You could incorporate pay-for-performance features. We have a little bit of that today. We've done a little bit in the past. Geographic factors, they've been very controversial. The old Rule 50 had them, the old Rule 49 had them, and in a revised way, the new rebasing law has geographic features. You could build in or not build in automatic inflation. Rule 50 did have it. Rebasing, as it was enacted, does not have automatic inflation. And then there's other policies that could be considered related to this, such as rate equalization. So to get at rate disparities, what can you do? Well, there's two ways to get it. One, you could redistribute the money that's already being spent. In other words, move to a pricing model. Or you could invest additional funding to bring up the lower end, which has been done on a few occasions in the past. If you'll look at, I just want to direct you to one particular chart, which is on page 11 in the report, and this is the last thing I'm going to do in my remarks. You'll see this graph on the bottom of page 11, and it shows for group 2, which is that sort of rural, and group three, which is the deep rural groups, what are their average rates by year as a percent of group three metro? And what you'll see, especially looking at the lower line, which is the group one compared to group three, that is back in 99, they were less than 80%. Their average rate was less than 80% of the metro. And that rose fairly sharply up to almost 86% over the next couple of years because of those disparity measures that I described, and then has been pretty much hovering around the same level. A similar change took place for group two, though not as dramatic. Mr. Chair, that's my remarks, if there's any questions.
Okay, I think we have a couple minutes for questions, if there are any. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Held, is there, I'm just concerned about medical inflation, which is much faster than regular inflation. Is there anything going on in nursing facilities that would cause that increase to be greater than just CPI?
Mr. Held.
I mean, are there new inventions coming out that are expensive to install and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, I nothing comes to mind. I mean, there are new technologies, and I think that many, many facilities have or would really like to invest in things like ceiling lifts, electronic medical records. But things along the lines of like CAT scans and all the really mega expensive things that are happening and the technology wars in the hospital and acute care field, I don't think it's nearly that type of a picture in nursing homes, not to my knowledge.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Held, thanks for that presentation. It's very helpful. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Medicare plays into this, even though that's not within our budget. I think members need to know that Medicare also pays for some care to nursing homes and in nursing homes and on a limited basis for certain of their patients. And how does that fit into the overall picture of what their revenue stream is, and you know, how does that impact maybe geographically different types of facilities, if you can?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I really don't have any geographic information available at the moment on Medicare, although I can try to pull together some of the numbers that have been reported to us on that. Medicare days account for somewhere between 8 and 9% of all nursing home days, and the rate paid by Medicare for those days on average is about 2.25 times the rate paid by Medicaid for the same resident. Medicare only covers a nursing home stay under very limited circumstances. It requires a 3-day prior hospitalization, and the person has to be recovering or declining. So the criteria for eligibility are very specific and restrictive. The industry generally, I believe, would characterize Medicare reimbursement as as being quite generous at this time, and help as the factor that helps make up the difference between Medicaid reimbursement and actual costs. The participation, almost all nursing homes are certified for Medicare and do have some days. But and the last point I was going to make on that is that the distribution of those days is quite uneven. So some facilities have successfully specialized in doing post-acute rehab and other types of complex care that will much more often be Medicare eligible and will have very high portions of their days that are Medicare. And other facilities will have and the majority of facilities will be below average, actually, on that. It's a skewed distribution.
All right. right. Mr. Held, thank you so much for your testimony. Our time is up for that. Next we have hearing on House File 19. If Representative Erdahl and his testifiers would please come forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Well, while he's coming, I'd like to just remind members we're going to be hearing four bills today. We won't be voting on them, but they'll be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And with that, I'd like to move the Erdahl bill for possible inclusion. And I also want to just, some members came late. We have a good contingency from the city of Watkins, which I understand is a good place to raise your kids, right, and to do many other things. So, yeah, I want to wave all the Watkins folks there. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Welcome. Thank you for that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very thankful for the opportunity to present to you today. Just would like to briefly acknowledge the citizens of the Watkins area that are with us today. Some of my DFL colleagues may remember that Watkins is the home of Senator Eugene McCarthy. We have McCarthy Park, but there's no cake out in the rain. Watkins Hilltop Care Center is a highly ranked nursing home in Watkins. They provide excellent care. Their daily census is about 95%. They're certified for 50 beds. Now, as Mr. Held explained to you, and I may just to summarize a little bit, Meeker County was once categorized as deep rural. Rural and metro, of course, being the other categories. But once those designations were dropped, historical precedents have been used for rates, essentially, rural, deep rural, and metro. Stearns County, located less than a quarter mile away, is in the higher rate. Thus, Watkins residents, because they are in Meeker County, just inside the line, receive $15 to $35 less per resident than Stearns County. This is an unfair disparity and has led to consequences to Watkins due to their proximity to the higher rate. A change is needed to ensure the viability of this home. I wish more could be done for all nursing homes, and Mr. Held and I have had many conversations with this, and I've had bills, and Representative Fritz knows that we've tried to fix this, and at times we thought we're on the right track. I know there isn't enough money this year to fix the whole problem, but I would ask that we help one nursing home that is in an unusual circumstance. They're highly rated, they're less than a quarter mile from a higher rate jurisdiction, and in danger of closing if we don't do something. This is about providing care for the residents and preserving the 86 jobs of the biggest employer in Watkins. And with that, I have some members of the administration of Watkins Hilltop Care Center with me, and they would now address you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm Beverly Mueller, the long-term care administrator at Hilltop Care Center. Hilltop Care Center is owned and operated by Painesville Area Healthcare System, who has the luxury of knowing about the disparity of the two nursing homes. We have a nursing home in Stearns County, Cronus Manor, and we have Hilltop in Watkins. And between the two homes, we do see the disparity of $15 to $35 per day in disparity. We do not distinguish our employees differently because of that disparity. But because of that disparity, we have a minimum of $300,000 per year loss without several of our allocations. So we definitely do feel the disparity and feel that it is definitely unfair, and it is becoming much more difficult for the system to absorb the loss as other medical costs are being cut today. And so we would greatly appreciate you readjusting the disparity between the MSA, which was given to us in 2006, and today, you know, and when you discuss Medicare payments, we definitely know the difference if you do have the high acuity of the Medicare. And because many of our residents have stayed with us, we don't always have the luxury of having the Medicare days because of length of stay. And with an occupancy of 95%, that sometimes gives us a disadvantage of getting some of those Medicare residents to our facility. We run a very efficient facility, and despite being efficient, we still have the loss. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives, and Dean Erdahl for helping us with this bill. My name is Annette Schrader, and I'm the director of nurses at Hilltop, and I've been there 12 years now. And I think one of the biggest struggles I've had is the disparity in the rates. We are less than a quarter of a mile from the Stearns County line. The next closest nursing home to us is in Cold Spring, which is 10 miles away from us. If our nursing home were to close or forced to have changes, the residents would be forced to go to the different counties with the higher paying counties. The other thing I'd like to point out is we could not survive without the support of Painesville Area Healthcare System. Except right now they're looking at restructuring, and that's part of our problem in the future. We don't know what's going to happen with Hilltop Care Center. We've been a five-star facility since the inception of the five-star rating, and we're very proud of that. This year we were number 34 out of 386 nursing homes in Minnesota on the Quality of Life Survey. Yet despite all the good cares and the strong reputation and the efficient caring staff that we have, and being ranked one of the top nursing homes, we cannot make a go of it financially. And a large part of that is because of the rate disparity. I want to thank you for your support, and also to help us keep our residents in the communities that they have their families and loved ones, so they don't have to travel. We get a lot of support from the community, so I appreciate your help.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, my name is Dennis Locke. I'm a Watkins City Councilman, and my wife and I have both been business people in Watkins for the past 20 years. My dad's mother spent the last years of her life at Hilltop, the last 3 years as a bedridden patient. My mom's mother and father both spent their final days at Hilltop. I've had numerous uncles, aunts, and other relatives that have been residents of Hilltop. Both my daughters have been certified nursing assistants at Hilltop. One went on to become a registered nurse, and her mentors are nurses at the Hilltop. The other went on to school to become a teacher. Both my daughters were taught to become very caring people while working at Hilltop. My grandchildren volunteer their time at Hilltop and enjoy their interactions with the residents and staff there. I tell you this to illustrate that Hilltop is more than just a nursing home to us. It is a hub of our community. It is our biggest employer with 86 employees and also supports many intergenerational activities. Thank you.
All right, and thank you. We have a couple of questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to extend greetings from Representative Larry Hosh, who's home today. I think one of his sons is ill, so he's home, and he knew that this bill was up today, and he wanted me to make sure and let you know that he's with you in spirit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've said in the past, our children, they graduate high school, come to the metro area to go to college. Our young adults come up here for jobs, and if we don't properly fund our nursing homes, you're going to get all of our elderly people as well. The question, I guess, would be directed to probably Ms. Schrader. Would you accept a challenge to be based on a performance-based versus a geographical base?
Administrator.
Yes, we would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Erdahl, and to the Director of Nurses and the rest of the folks there for coming again today. And I worked, you know, in the nursing home as a licensed practical nurse for 35 years and have family working there now, and I really appreciate the gentleman, Mr. Long's comments about your daughters, and I have daughters and granddaughters now working in the nursing home, and also what an opportunity it is for all of our young people to visit, to volunteer, and to humble themselves to see that this is earth, not heaven, and that people do age out, and that we can be of service, and that service can actually provide jobs and opportunities for all of our communities. So I thank you very much for bringing this today.
Okay, is there anything else? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erdahl, just curious, how many, if any, of these nursing homes fall in this kind of category that they're within close proximity to another adjoining nursing home that would have this same situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative
Erdahl.
I know of none closer.
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, does anyone have that information? Is that Mr. Held?
Mr. Held.
It just feels so right, you know.
Just because I'm a chairman this year, you don't have to kneel.
The bill specifies, Mr. Chair, the bill specifies that this applies to facilities that are within 1/4 mile of the line, and there's only one facility that meets that requirement in Minnesota.
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, so Representative Erdahl, because of the very unique situation, and it's only this one instance in the state, you would probably recommend that I support this as well.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McDonald, yes, I only deal with unique circumstances. Certainly would urge you to support this because of it.
Mm-hmm. Representative McDonald?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for coming. And with that, I will renew Representative Abler's motion to lay over the bill for possible consideration later in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Okay, next we have House File 239. If Representative Purcell would come down with your testifiers. Representative Murphy, would you like to move this bill for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 239 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This bill was brought to me. I believe it's been before the House previously. I think we've got a similar vein going with several bills here today, but this, in a nutshell, is requesting an increase in daily rate for an intermediate care facility for the developmentally disabled located in Clearwater County. And this is a 15-bed facility, and I have with me today, of course, you see Representative Hancock with me as well. We're co-authors on this bill, and Mr. Don Blueflat, who is the overseer of the facility. And I would like to turn it over to him for a little bit more explanation, and then we'd stand for questions.
Mr. Blomquist.
Well, I was here last year also explaining the plight of Pine Ridge residents, and at that time we were receiving $112.73 a day as a rate, and the average Class A bed in April 1st of 08 in a study I got from the Department of Human Services was $180.59 a day. So we did receive an increase in rates from the legislature up to $138.23, which enabled us to come into the black for the first time in 3 years in 2010. It started July 1st of 2010. But the unfortunate thing is it was okayed for only 1 year, so it ends now on June 30th of 2011. And at that time, as I understand, we'd go back to our $112.73 rate again. And we just wouldn't be able to make it. I cashed in two of the operating CDs that we had managed to accrue in the 35 years we'd been in operation. And we didn't make enough in 2010, of course, to replenish any of them. But we are able to make it and stay into the black with the new rate. And I would just like to encourage everyone to consider making that a permanent rate for us so that we can withstand any necessary cuts that might come into the future as people try, as the legislature and the governor try to come around and deal with the $6.2 billion deficit that's facing Minnesota. I'm understanding right now that there's a 4.5% cut in rates that Governor Dayton has presented so far, and if that happened to our $112 rate, we wouldn't make it through the year. But if we could get the rate in a permanent vein, the 138, we could withstand a cut and still stay in business. We do have 28 staff people that work at our ICF DD, I guess it's called now. I just learned that today. It had always been an ICFMR for the 38 years I've been there. But anyway, our wage range is for the direct service staff goes from $8.46 an hour to $13.40 an hour. So you can see that no one's getting rich off it, but we do have people that have been there for a long time. We have four staff that have been there 26 years plus, two that have been there 21 to 25 years, two that have been there for 16 to 20 years, four that have been there from 11 to 15 years, six that have been there from 6 to 10 years, six that have been there from 2 to 5 years, and just four that are 1 year or less. Once we get somebody there and they meet our residents and get to interact with them, they don't seem to leave. Even though they're not highly compensated, they take the residents in as part of their families. Even though they have families of their own, it's an extended family, and they really get attached to them fast. I can attest to that. In 1972, I did an internship from college as part of a social work class, and the only internship I could get was at the DT&H. At that time, it was called the Day Activity Center in our town, and it had seven people at that particular time. And I've been there ever since, and they hired me a couple years after I started at the DT&H to start the ICFMR because the deinstitutionalization mode was in, where we were at that time called a home and community-based service, and now all of a sudden ICFs are kind of out of that, and they're going to smaller homes yet. But all of our residents really, really love our home. And if we had to close up, there's a moratorium, as I understand it, on waiver homes, so no one else could start, but we could build for those 15 people. But back when they were trying to downsize ICFMRs, my board looked into it, and it would take four homes to make up for the ICFMR. And there isn't any five-bedroom actually is what you need for a waiver-type situation. There's a bedroom for each person that lives there and then one for the person that stays overnight. But at that time, we were looking at some over $200,000 per home, which would have made, you know, $800,000 to $900,000 of cost to build the four homes, and then the staffing would have been on top of that. It would take more staff, I think, for the four homes than for our one home. And plus, the family would be broke up. I mean, everybody that lives there considers everyone else their family, even though they have their mother and dad that in some instances that come to visit them, or they have a brother or sister that comes. We have a kind of a unique situation, and one of the residents' sister and her husband wanted to build a gazebo for us because every time they came to visit their brother, it was raining or snowing. And he liked to be outside and doing things with them and showing them around and stuff. So they wanted to build a gazebo. Well, they wanted to make it big enough so the whole house could make use of it. And it turned into a $42,000 building because they also wanted to put a fireplace in so we could shut the combination windows and use it in the early fall and early spring. And when I put an ad or a story in the paper about our financial plight, I had a lot of resident or community members coming over and said, well, why in the world did you waste all that money building that building behind your facility when you're in such trouble? And I keep trying to explain, we didn't build that, you know, we just graciously accepted it, and it's been a very, very popular thing with all the residents. And of course that would be something they would miss out on too if we had to break everything down, and I don't know how we would sell a place of that size with everything. But anyway, I'd really like to encourage you to, it doesn't cost the state of Minnesota a whole lot. I think it was $48,000 was the tag for fiscal year 2011, and I think it goes up to 60 years because there's a $60,000 because there's a different match with the federal government on Medicare and Medicaid. But anyway, I'd be open to any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Blueflat, for coming down and sharing the story again. I had the occasion to go visit Pine Ridge over the summer. I guess it was in the early fall. I did because we were able to do a temporary rate increase last year, and they had invited us up after that. And I'll tell you, it is a home for the people that live there. There are some of the residents have been there since I think the facility opened. I think the oldest resident is 81 years old.
And it really is a home and a family, and that's why I think it's important that we consider this this session. So thank you for hearing it today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Abler.
Thank you. Is this Mr. Held's department? Or I'm just curious, maybe we can get a list, maybe not for now, but if we can get a list of the what the rate distribution is like on this. I'm not real familiar with that. It's not a geographic issue, it's a historic issue. And there's quite a curve, I expect, and I'm curious for my information what other ones are so precarious as this one, and what the ones who are at the top of the rate scale are, what their world is like. And so I think that would be helpful to me. So maybe the department can get that. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one more thing. Of our 15 residents, we have 12 that are basically classified in the Class A bed, and we have 3 residents that are classified in a Class B type facility. So we have 3 beds in Class B and 12 in Class A. Class B beds, of course, are those that are non-ambulatory and not capable of reacting in an emergency situation. And we have never gotten any kind of a rate increase for having those 3 Class B beds either. And, of course, they're much higher than the 180, and I think, you know, listening to Alex Bartolik when she talked, I think the average sounds like it's $210 a day now from what figures she gave, rather than the 180 that I got that was effective in April of 08. So we're way down, and even with the $138, we're still far under any other Class A. And for sure, if you add the Class 3 beds, we would really be under. You know, so just something extra. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Blofat, is that the correct pronunciation?
Blue flat.
All right. Thank you. What is the cost on average of your residence? I see if we do increase it up to $138.23, that seems low as to your cost per resident. So just curious if you know their cost per bed per resident, and does that include all cost capital improvements or heating, electricity, all the costs associated with running Pine Ridge?
Per diem includes all of the costs in running it, salaries, heat, utilities, all utilities, depreciation if there's any on building and equipment, transportation for driving the residents to medical appointments or shopping trips or things like that. So it includes everything that it takes to operate the home. Did I answer your question?
Well, I was just
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I was just curious as to does this cover your cost if it is a rate increase of $138.23?
Yes, it does.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Blueflat, then how does your rate then per diem compare to some other of your some other homes in your area?
Mr. Blueflat.
Well, there are no other ICFMR or ICFDD homes in our immediate area. There used to be one in Fossen, which is 18 miles away, and they disbanded and went in. Some profit corporations came in and started the 4-bed waiver homes. And in Bemidji, there used to be 3 ICFMRs, and they did the same thing. They disbanded and went to the 4-bed waiver homes. So there isn't any. I think in Thief River Falls, which is about 65 miles away, there used to be one that was there, but I'm not sure if that one is in operation yet either. But that would have been the closest one now.
Okay, and with that, I will move to renew Representative Murphy's motion to lay over this bill for possible consideration later in the omnibus bill. Next up is House File 272, Representative Nordis. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate it very much.
And I guess I'll move to have this bill heard and laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Right.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. Thank you for giving me a few minutes. I know all nursing homes could be here, and all of them would tell you probably the same story, that it's very difficult and getting harder. I'm here representing two of the nursing homes in my community of Fergus Falls. We actually have three when you count the veterans home that's there. And we're proud of all three. The veterans home is actually probably one of the finest in the state. It's probably the newest also. And soon to be opening another 20-bed wing for the Alzheimer's and other type special residents. So we're happy about that. The Pioneer community is actually on a $20 million capital improvement project right now, and by this spring, early this summer, they'll have a brand new facility that they'll be operating. So the Brown home, which is the third facility, also has been upgrading over time, and so they're all I call quality nursing homes. The reason that I'm here, because it sounds like we're in pretty good shape, but the reason I'm here is that we have what I'd consider an unfair situation when you take into consideration the veterans home and those other two facilities. And we're talking rates. The veterans home is reimbursed at the metro rate. The two homes that are technically in competition do not. And so there's quite a difference in the way that they're required to build their budgets. I should also mention that my father was an eight-year resident of the Pioneer community, and my mother-in-law not quite that long, but we have experience firsthand with these facilities. But just as a comparison here, I'll show you what we're dealing with. And I should also add that Laverne, I believe, is in the same situation that Fergus Falls is in at this time. So all the other veterans' homes, the communities that host them, are all being reimbursed at the metro rate. So we're trying to talk, and I guess fairness is the word that I think of most often. But just as an example, when you're talking about hiring personnel, take an RN, for example. A starting salary at the veterans home is $24.26. At the Brown home, and I don't have the numbers for the Pioneer home, but it'd be very close. At the Brown home, it's $19.43, so we're looking at $4.83 difference per hour for that one position. And if the, again, taking the Brown home as an example, if they were to raise their salaries so that they're competitive with the veterans home, it would cost them a $283,000 annually. Insurance is another area where veterans, employees, single ones, I believe, get free insurance, where the others do not and cannot provide that. That's an additional $114,000 in operating costs if they were to provide the same benefits. So I guess basically to make a presentation as short as I can, and I know you're short on time, that's what it's about. And I know every nursing home would like to have more money, and I know you're looking at probably even less money. So it's a tough situation, I know that. But it's one of those situations where it seems to be setting up an situation that if there's some way to adjust for that, I know they would be appreciative of that. There are other nursing homes within 20 miles of the same situation that are not included in this legislation, and I know they would also like to be, but the most impact is on the two homes that I mentioned, the Pioneer Home, Pioneer Community, and the Brown Home. So I'll stand for questions if you have one or two.
All right. And Representative Nornes, did you have any other testifiers that were able to get to?
I do not. I should have mentioned that.
since we only had a few minutes, I suggested maybe it wasn't worth the six-hour trip. Not that it's not worth, I mean, I maybe didn't state that exactly right, but we wanted to be brief, to the point, and that's why I was given some information to share with you, and again, it saved two men driving 6 hours.
All right. Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nornes. We can see the invisible crowd behind you, yes. So no problem there. We all understand that situation. First of all, I just want to say, you know, coming from Rochester, I understand there's. I had to step out from some of the previous testimony, but you know, this issue about competition and being unable to compete is one that the nursing homes in my area have this issue too, because we've got the Mayo Clinic there. So you think, well, you know, things are really good there, but the Mayo Clinic competes for employees with the nursing homes, who have the same kind of financial problems and are under low rates too. So I understand the situation, and it's a statewide problem for a lot of us. The question I have for you, and maybe staff would have to answer, you were talking about veterans' homes as being the competitive entities in your area. And the question I have is, are those homes, you said they're funded at the metro rate, but is that their only funding stream, or do they get some kind of special federal funding because we're dealing with veterans, or do the veterans themselves bring in some funding? How does that all work?
I wish I could explain that to you, and maybe someone else can here, because I guess I'm not clear on how all of that works.
Looks like Mr. Held
may have an answer for you.
Mr. Chair, the veterans' homes are not in the Medicaid program, so I don't know exactly how their rates are set, but I know that there's not a metro thing that has to do with the veterans' homes. Not in regard to Medicaid.
So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Held, how are those funded? I mean, I know this isn't really your area, but, you know, just in general, are those funded then by the federal government? Because I know we do some veterans' facilities that we do have that are our state facilities. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe there are federal monies that are involved in it, and I believe it is also a state contribution to that, probably not through this committee.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative.
I'm just advised by staff we can get some information about that so people know how they're funded, since it'd be nice to know.
Thank you.
Yeah. And if I could just respond, in general, what I'm attempting to do here today, if I didn't make myself clear, is that the other communities where there are veterans' homes, we're just trying to treat all of them the same. That's the end result of what we're attempting to do here today.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes. No, I do understand that, and that's why I made my comment, because I think it was Representative Purcell was here before you have a regional center, or you have one area where you've got higher rates and another where you've got lower rates. Naturally, you know, the competition for employees is going to, the best employees are then going to get siphoned off to the people who can pay better wages. So I understand this is an issue about being able to give good service everywhere.
Mr. Chair, I also was here early enough to hear a lot of the testimony, and as a previous member of this committee, it's very complicated, the whole system of how nursing home rates are established, and I'm glad you're doing it and not me.
Are there any further questions? If not, then I will renew my motion to lay over this bill for possible consideration later in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Nornes.
And next up we have House File 315. If Representative Fritz and her testifiers would please come forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
While they're coming and getting set up, let me just announce that tomorrow we're going to be taking up House File 8, and we're also going to be hearing considerable numbers of people with testimony about the governor's bill, and I think we're having short testimonies. We'll be having 2 minutes for some 30, six different entities or people wishing to comment. I'm not sure if those entities are listening now, but if they want to bring something written, which has more mass than the 2 minutes, and I think that you'd be surprised how quickly it goes, 2 minutes, but also what you can get in that's meaty and valuable. So that'll be tomorrow. So.
Representative Fritz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I am here today again with a plea to this committee and to the legislature to increase the rates to all nursing homes.
Representative
throughout
Fritz, just a second. Sorry, could you move your bill first?
I'm sorry, yes.
Sorry, thank you.
I would like to move House File 315 to be included in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been involved with the Seniors and Workers Coalition, who are with me today along with others. The Seniors and Workers Coalition and I have been together for 11 years. We've testified before this committee and the Senate for all of those 11 years, and I myself, as a nurse working in the nursing home industry in Greater Minnesota, have testified before these committees for the past 30 years for the asking of a rate increase, a fair rate increase to the nursing homes in throughout the state of Minnesota. Again, this year I've asked for a 4% increase. I've asked for a 10% increase over the years, a 7% increase over the years. I believe since I've been elected, we've actually received a 2.5% increase at one time, and we were I was able to work with in a very bipartisan way, and I see many folks on both sides here who have worked with me for trying to find ways that Mr. Held talked to us about in finding monies for our nursing homes, and the rebasing was one of the pieces of legislation that we did enact, and again, because of budget problems, we have not been able to catch up, and we may never catch up with the rates and the money that we need. But I will say this, at today asking for 4%, we are 20% behind. And I do have folks with me from not only from the nursing home industry, but the disabled community as well. In my bill, we have included everyone. And I do want to add also that in my legislative career, we have cut. We have cut over $1 billion in the health in this committee, and the people that we've cut the most are the most vulnerable, those folks in our nursing homes, in our disabled community. So I ask you to listen to the people again that I brought today. They'll be brief, and I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman, as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Jake. You stay right there.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Vanessa Warner, who's on the agenda, will no longer be speaking today. She had a complicated care issue and she had to stay at home, but in her place, there's another person, Mark Kerwin, who would like to testify.
All right, could you please introduce yourself and please spell your last name for the record?
My name is Mark Kerwin, K-I-R-W-I-N.
All right, proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am here to talk about my wife, Christine. She's 44, and she had MS, and about 4 years ago she got really sick and was in the hospital quite a bit, and since that time she's been able to stay at home with the help of 52 hours per week of RNs. And it has really worked out well in a lot of ways for her to be able to stay at home. I guess from the financial perspective, I think it's more cost-effective for her to be at home than in a facility. And it's from a care perspective, it's been really good because I feel like I do a good job of keeping an eye on her, and I'm there with her every day. To monitor different things, and I have quite a bit of experience working with her, so I feel like I kind of know what I'm doing, and I can work with the nurses and sort of tell which ones are doing a good job or not. And it's just from a mental health point of view, it's really good for our family being together in the same house. and not having to go to a facility to visit her all the time. And she's when she's feeling up to it, I'm able to bring her out to do short activities or family functions. And I really think it's been a good program, and I would like to see it protected and strengthened. I think it, you know, I've had a really good experience with it, and I would like to see some of the better nurses, you know, stay in the home care profession rather than pursuing higher paying hospital jobs. So I guess that's pretty much it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Jane Okramovich. I'm a volunteer who serves as president of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Care Coalition. And this is a coalition whose mission is to improve the quality of long-term care for those who depend on it and for those who provide it. As Representative Fritz mentioned, for the past 11 years, we've been concerned with many of the same issues that past members of this committee have dealt with. Issues such as rate reimbursement to nursing homes and support for home and community-based services, which has shown to be one of the most cost-effective means to provide long-term care services. These long-term care services are crucial for our seniors and those with disabilities who depend on and desperately need them to live a quality life. We've heard from the providers that staff had to be reduced, and from workers we know of their concerns for working short-staffed and increased hours. Our coalition has tried to point out the importance of supporting the direct care workers if any increase in payment is received. We think that House File 315 is a sensible approach in this endeavor, as it provides an increase across the board to all long-term care providers rather than a piecemeal approach of one bill addressing a few homes in a particular location. It guarantees that the people who provide the care receive some benefit for their hard work and training. I'd like to turn to Sonia Lemire of Parkview Care Center now for that worker perspective, and then following her will be Lynn Zimmerman of Adult Day Services, who will speak on the management aspect of what the cuts over the last 10 years have meant in her agency. And she is accompanied by Karen Thompson, a caregiver whose mother uses Adult Day Services. Sonia?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sonia Lemire. I am a licensed practical nurse at Parkview Care Center in Buffalo. I did need to get permission for time off from work, and I had to use a vacation day to be here today. I am proud to work with some of the most dedicated caregivers in Minnesota, but dedication goes only so far. Chronic underfunding means low staffing levels. Sometimes low staffing levels means residents don't get the dignity they deserve. Dignity may often be the only thing left for those in the final stages of their lives. I work in the memory loss unit with 30 residents. These are our most vulnerable elderly. Yet each one of them is someone's grandmother, grandfather, mom, or dad. I am the only nurse in charge of all 30 residents. This allows only 16 minutes per resident in an 8-hour shift. These minutes include passing medications, all within a time frame, doing all the treatments, assist with doctor rounds, updating family members, and most importantly, documenting in the legal record all aspects of medical observations, social behaviors, medication orders, and maintaining current care plans for each of the 30 residents. I also am responsible to supervise personal cares for all 30 residents. This leaves no time for resident interaction. They have the right to receive our respect and be treated as a whole person, not hurried. I would like to be able to go to work and finish my day knowing I did my best in meeting each of my residents' needs. It's almost not humanly possible to give quality care or prevent accidents with current reimbursement rates. Our nursing home in Wright County sits 10 miles from the Hennepin County border, another mileage issue, thus is classified rural with rural reimbursement rates, not metro reimbursement rates. This causes a significant amount of less revenue for our nursing home to provide safe staffing levels.
And be it assured that 75% of this proposed increase will be going to the frontline workers. For the past 8 years, working families like mine have continued to get the squeeze while we fail to ask every Minnesotan to pay their fair share. Workers understand these are hard times, but nursing home workers like me are getting tired of seeing money to care for our nation's greatest generation on the chopping block year after year. For me, it comes down to priorities. We can either keep trying to squeeze blood out of a turnip and put the quality of resident care at risk, or we can remember, as Hubert Humphrey did, that the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. Representative Fritz's bill ensures that, as a state, we pass Mr. Humphrey's test and stand up for nursing home residents and those of us who lovingly care for them. Thank you.
And now Lynn Zimmerman of Adult Day Services.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lynn Zimmerman, and I qualify as a twofer. I not only am a senior, but I'm also a worker. And I've been a healthcare worker for nearly 50 years in hospitals, nursing homes, outpatient rehab facilities, home health, and adult day centers. I have experience as a direct care worker, supervisor, manager, consultant, clinical instructor, an entrepreneur, a patient, and a family caregiver. I have seen the best of times, and I hope the worst of times. The projected growth in our older population has created a growing awareness of the importance of managing chronic illness, which impacts not only the individual, but also families and friends who provide care and assistance. Adult day centers are a community resource for care planning, health oversight, and treatment, and assistance with activities of daily living, as well as caregiver support. A long-term care worker can assist folks to move better, feel better, and engage with life. But unlike the problems that are solved with acute specialty care, the issues addressed in long-term care never really go away. They are, by definition, chronic. Workers in long-term care support spouses, partners, friends, and family members who need to keep their jobs, pay taxes, go to school, and get the necessary respite that relieves the strain of 24-hour care. Access to affordable, quality long-term care helps to keep caregivers themselves healthier and less likely to suffer disease and accidents caused by the stress of providing continuous care. As lawmakers, you are challenged to find ways to provide cost-efficient, cost-effective, and high-quality care for our most vulnerable citizens. Minnesota has a system in place that can deliver that service. But like any delivery system, it will break down, erode, and fail if it's not adequately maintained and improved. I think our long-term care system is a lot like household plumbing. It's essential for healthy living, it's not pretty to look at, and it's never prominently displayed. If not properly maintained, the system starts to wear out. And when the pipes start to fail, everyone feels the ramifications of its loss. I've never met anyone who casually waits for a plumber to arrive. And I've never met a plumber who doesn't say, yeah, he can fix it, but it will cost a lot more than you expected because you ignored the signs of a growing problem for far too long. Past cuts to home and community-based services have placed great pressure on a system that is effective and well-designed. And as you know, health and community-based services were cut 2.58% in the 2009 biennium. Please be aware that possible future cuts will strain the system so much that it really may fail. Poorly reimbursed service providers cannot adequately pay wages and benefits to dedicated and skilled workers who are the providers of the quality care. Nor can they design, improve, and maintain environments that enhance the quality and experience of the care recipients. Without proper reimbursement, our system of long-term care in Minnesota will become less efficient and begin to rust. Without proper maintenance, quality will be lost. Please do all you can to sustain a system that provides services as necessary as water to those who must depend on affordable access to quality, long-term, chronic care.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I'm Karen Thompson, and I'm a caregiver. My mother has Alzheimer's. In fact, for 7 years, she's been a customer at Lynn's Daycare, Common Sense. It's really been important for our family. We chose, rather than the nursing home option, to care for my mother at home, who's lived in that same home since 1953. As my 8 brothers and sisters can all attest to, that was a very important choice for us. We know that she receives excellent care. We can monitor that, and we know every single day that she gets what she needs with really people who are staff that really care and show that loving environment. And that's really essential and important to us as a family member, and I'm sure it would be to all of you if it was your parent or someone else that was dearly loved in your family. One of the things that we are starting to see is the reduction of staff, as well as turnover of staff, and that's really bothersome to me. Working like I do every day, having that same staff that's there to support you is really crucial, really elementary in terms of the type of care that you want. I'll have to say that because of the daycare that we have and the support we receive, I've never had to take one day off of work to deal with any issue other than taking my mother to a doctor's appointment and being here today for something that I feel is very, very important. Thank you.
So, just the last comment very quickly. This legislative session also has set as a priority jobs. And we see the long-term care industry as the area that will expand, and support is necessary because the need for workers is growing. However, all workers want to be valued for their efforts and not be afraid of injury because of another person not being available to help them. A reminder, many communities in greater Minnesota, as you've heard today, depend on these workers as a vital part of the economy. Please show those who receive these services and those who provide them that they are valued, and we thank you for this opportunity.
Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson. Kevin Goodnow is on the agenda, and I am not Kevin Goodnow, but I am Bruce Nelson, and I will speak on behalf of the Day Training and Habilitation Services as well, and we work together jointly as a community of caregivers and providers a lot. ARM is an association of providers of folks who serve people in the waivers, ICFSMR that you heard about earlier today, SILS, and the people that our members, about 150 of them, provide services to have developmental disabilities, brain injuries, mental health, autism, and physical disabilities. First off, I will be brief, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you, Representative Fritz, for your leadership over the years and certainly now in this difficult time, and many folks on the committee as well. For especially in the House of Representatives, I hope there's no senators here, for your leadership on behalf of people with disabilities and the elderly. I want to speak about three groups of wonderful people. First, people with disabilities who live in group homes or in home, or get served during the day by day training and habilitation. Caregivers, we heard about some wages earlier. Who really are, who get 76% of all the funding, And caregivers, in my mind, means services, means care. The average wage among our members is $11.56. And finally, providers. Most of them are small to medium-sized businesses, for-profit and not-for-profit, and provide many jobs in every community. Representative Abler, you've said many times over the years, especially in times of fiscal woe, that we need to look at what's essential and what's nice. And I know you're struggling this year in trying to figure out what are the limits of government. What should government be all about? What should it do? And those are tough decisions that you're going to have to make. But I would maintain, as the House has in the last couple of years, that services to the elderly, services to people with disabilities are essential core services. These are our most vulnerable citizens, and it's been bipartisan over the years, and I trust that as things get tough down the road, that you will look upon services to these two groups of vulnerable people as essential core government services. Our staff prepared a quick overview and use the waiver as an example, because I know many of you are new members on the committee, and it's a very complicated system, but this is just so you get a sense of where the money goes and how it goes. This is just the waiver programs, Developmental Disabilities, TDI, CADI, CAC. Over on the left where it says state money, DHS, well, keep in mind that's, except for expanded FMAP, that's 50-50 federal dollars. So $1 raised or cut in state coffers is $2 in services. That money goes to the counties in a huge allocation. And then there's work with the case manager and other people, the bottom back box there, to figure out individual service plans. And then the providers work with the...
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Maybe 20 more seconds?
20 more seconds. Okay.
Thanks.
I will cut to the chase, and I just want you to take a look at that big box. And I'm sorry I meandered. The big box there shows the disparity between rate increases or declines or changes and the actual cost of living, keeping in mind, and it's 13% difference since fiscal year 2004, and keep in mind that is money that goes almost exclusively to the caregivers, which is care.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have one last testifier who did come all the way from Bemidji. I would like him to have a couple of minutes if that's possible.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mike McAllop. I'm from Bemidji, Minnesota. It's MCCALIP. I'm an aide at the Nielsen Place for North Country Health Services. Under the corporation, we have a hospital, a nursing home, a memory care unit, and a new non-subsidized assisted living apartment building. I'm a nursing assistant at the nursing home. Our union agreed to a wage freeze for 2010 and a pay cut for future employees. This year our employer is asking for a $4 an hour pay cut from current employees. The situation in our nursing home is getting worse this last year, short on supplies, tents, washcloths, wipes, linen. We're short-staffed, bare bones. I worked this last weekend. Collins, they don't get replaced. The last several years, we've managed to bring down injuries from say 2007, we had 40 injuries in 1 year. We brought it down to 10. I think we're currently at 12. We work hard to have a staff lift and turn properly, but when you're short-staffed, you get rushed, injuries happen. I think the average injury rate is about $10,000 an injury. Staff injuries lead to resident injuries. The nursing motto is nursing safety is your resident safety. Work the evening shift, 3 to 11. The 20 residents in the neighborhood, I take care of 12 of them. Eight of them require assistance to eat. Like I said, I put 12 of them to bed, cook their supper, pass their meds, do the dishes, clean their room, clean their laundry. And when the time comes, I'm the one that prays over the bed. My residents range from 25 to 100 years old. The 25-year-old is a TBI. I can wash her hair once a week. It's supposed to be a toilet every 2 hours. I was just telling Sarah today, I said, a resident on my shift gets toileted and changed twice. I've considered it a good shift. Double hanging tens, soaker pads. I can tell you about those. Neglect, dignity, restraints. And talk about that. Last night I worked the first 4 hours of my shift in another neighborhood. Not familiar with those 20 residents. Spent 4 hours. Probably could have done, you know, I do pretty good. And the problem, you have to slow down to read the MAR, you know, not knowing the resident's name. New admins, I don't know what they look like. Three of the residents, I had to ask staff, is this the resident? I finished my shift in my neighborhood. What else can I tell you? Last year, our facility faced a $1 million budgeted loss. This year we're on budget to lose $2.2 million. Like I told you this last year, our salaries have been frozen.
Thank you, Mike. I think that he has certainly told the story. I feel like I just relived my entire career. This is nothing new. In my career, we gave back 10% of our wages to keep our facility afloat. And this is something that many, many nursing homes throughout the state do. And because we have dedicated, compassionate, caring people wanting to do the best job they can for our very frail elderly people who are unable to care for themselves. It's a great opportunity for us to serve our fellow man, but we can't do it with the low rates and no rate increases. So I ask you to search your consciences and your hearts and to not cut us and to please keep us safe and to give us 4% increase in our rates this year. And we'll have to look together to find it under some rock. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
Well, and thank you. Representative Pritz, I think you've given us an elegant presentation of this impossible task. And I was hoping over the course of today we'd get some view of the long-term care nursing home world. I think it's been quite a good day. of learning about that. And I want to thank your witnesses for coming from distance and taking a holiday. It's very productive. You heard about all the smaller projects, the bigger picture. Our work is cut out for us. Thank you for helping with the message today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
And with that, I will renew Representative Fritz's motion to lay over this bill for possible consideration later in the omnibus bill. And with that, we are adjourned.